And gentlemen, sorry to interrupt your happy chatter over lunch. I want to make sure we have time for talk at the end of today's session. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Thomson Reuters here in Hong Kong and the Board of Governors at the FCC. Welcome to the club. Before we get started, just a few housekeeping notes on upcoming events. We have a busy series of luncheons coming up over the next few weeks. Our next lunch is tomorrow, where we'll be talking about Myanmar's political and economic awakening. That's with Mr. Hans Vriens. And after that, coming up on the 21st of May, Professor Chen Guangcheng will be joining us from China, and he'll be talking about how China revised its criminal procedure code. A few more events to come after that, but please do sign up. As you know, seats are limited. We're absolutely sold out today. Now, on to our event of the day, and Professor Vogel. For most of you in the room, I think he needs no introduction. I've had seen many people already coming up asking for book signings, and anyone who's done any reading, studying, or a general interest into China is well familiar with his works. The latest project for Professor Vogel is getting his new book into China, and hopefully we'll be hearing about that over the next few months. But just by way of a quick intro, he's author of several books, a professor emeritus at Harvard University in Boston, Massachusetts. And his latest book, Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, his latest work. I did ask him over lunch whether he was done with Deng after all the years of research, and he said, not quite. So we look forward to hearing him speak. Professor?
Thank you very much, Tara. It's a great pleasure to be back in Hong Kong. VG, who goes way back, and I were talking about some of the old days when the Foreign Correspondents Club was a place where journalists met rather than bankers and lawyers. In the old days when China was just opening up, I was here for a year in 63, 64, and for the next decade before we could move into China, I was back here almost every summer for a few months. Trying to keep up with what was going on in the mainland. In those days, we had very close relations between journalists and government and business people and as foreign academics. I've had the pleasure of coming back to Hong Kong often, and it's always exhilarating to be here. There's a tremendous dynamism and a kind of special quality that I find very attractive. When I was thinking in the year 2000 what to do with my life, I decided that I was ready to retire from teaching, leaving that to younger people, and that I wanted to try to make a contribution to American understanding of Asia. A few decades before, when Japan was just beginning to rise, I wrote this book, Japan is Number One, which some of my friends felt played a role in helping prepare America for the fact that Japan was coming on strong and to try to understand some of the features that Japan had that Americans ought to know more about. So in the year 2000, when I was trying to think about what to write about, I didn't have to have such a shocking title as Number One. People knew China was on the way up and was going to play an even bigger role. The rise of China was no longer news. The question for an academic was, what can I do to contribute to fairly long-term, deeper understanding? There's no way we academics can compete with journalists or government people in talking about current events. But I think what our contribution can be is in examining things that happened a few years earlier, where there are more records available, where there are more people to talk to, and then trying to put together a picture. And of course, in trying to understand contemporary China, there was nothing more important than the Deng Xiaoping and Deng Xiaoping's era and how he went about transforming it. I was quite surprised when I first started doing the work in the year 2000. I was afraid of having too much competition. My wife kept telling me, hurry up and get done, because other people might beat you to it. She didn't like the mess I made in the study and all over the house while I was carrying all my materials. But the fact is that nobody else has done this kind of study. I find it rather surprising. We have several big books on Mao, but when I try to think who had done a really good book on Deng, there really isn't much. Richard Evans, who was British ambassador in Beijing, had done a short book on Deng that was really quite a good book, but it was mainly to sort of place Deng in the historical perspective, what was happening in China, and use that as a way to inform the Western audience. But I really wanted to dig deeper and give a comprehensive view about Deng. I think I was lucky in the timing of the study and the timing when the book was coming out. If I had written the book in the early 1990s and it came out then, I think there would have been no interest. People were so furious at Deng for putting down June 4th, 1989. The hatred was so strong. He was, as Clinton said in his campaign, the butchers of Beijing. And I think nobody would have been interested in the historical role. But I think now we have enough distance, and there are young people who don't even remember the days of Tiananmen. Even the people who do remember are more willing to say, okay, well, that's what happened, but what really was the historical role of Deng? So I think I'm lucky that the book is done at that time. There's another thing I think was good, I think good luck, and that is that if I had done the book while he was still alive, there would not have been as many historical records. And while I was working on the book, a lot of historical materials came out, the Deng Xiaoping Nianpu, the basic chronology of his administration, came out one of the early years from based on materials from 75 to 1997. And before I finished my book, the earlier volumes came out. So I had five volumes of sort of basic chronological records from the mainland. That was a wonderful kind of baseline of the facts. But of course, year by year, there'll be more materials that'll be released. So a person 50 years from now would be able to find more materials. But the advantage I have compared to them is that I can still interview a lot of people who knew Deng. I was able to interview a lot of his children. I was able to interview the children of high-level officials. It's interesting that the high-level officials did not tell the secrets to their kids. Their kids were almost like China watchers. They observed who their parents were seeing and how they, their moods and so forth, and they tried to guess. But it's like an intelligence service that has levels of secrecy, and even the kids who were party members and had party positions were not high enough to be told the secrets by their parents. So they knew a lot. They had a feel. I talked to a lot of officials who worked under Deng, and I would say there are two main kinds of officials that I found particularly useful. Some were fairly conservative. I operated in Beijing for years at a place called Deng Dai Qingguo Yanjiushuo, a contemporary China research institute, and there were some good scholars there. And then they were rather conservative in their views. They liked Chen Yun, and they were not in favor of democratic reforms. And then there was quite a group that was affiliated with a journal in Beijing called Yanhuang Chunqiao. And the people affiliated with that journal tended to be liberal officials, some of whom had high positions. And after they retired, they would often write their memoirs or be willing to talk to foreigners. They were much more appreciative of Hu Yaobang than they were of Deng Xiaoping. They mostly disliked Deng Xiaoping, probably should have done a lot more. So I was able to get those different perspectives. And then, of course, I was able to talk to a lot of foreigners. who had had negotiations, not only American officials, but people like Lee Kuan Yew, because I was the one at Harvard who had welcomed Jiang Zemin when he came. I was able to interview Jiang Zemin about what his views on Deng, and of course President Carter and a number of others who had known Deng. And gradually those records came out. In some ways, I changed my view of Deng. When I started out, there were a lot of things I didn't know that I think now I can describe in a fuller way. To start off with, I think he is given too much credit for starting reform and opening. You know, in Chinese history, the person who wins out is moral and righteous and correct and wise, and the person who loses out is a scoundrel and done everything wrong and was dumb and had the wrong policies. And so the official history sort of puts Deng as starting reform and opening, and Hua Guofeng as being the oaf who was too stuck to Mao. But I think as I learned more about it, Hua Guofeng was really not so conservative. He was already willing to do a lot of things to support reform. He had been supportive of sending the Gumu delegation to Europe in May 1978 and sending other delegations abroad. He was not so stuck on Mao's views as the two whatevers, the slogan that sort of pasted him for being too close to Mao. In fact, he wrested the Gang of Four, which was not something Mao would have done. So I think he was much more open. And another thing I learned about Deng, I don't think it's fair to think of him as an architect. That's a common term that's used to describe him. An architect, to me at least, implies he have a blueprint. He had a fairly clear notion of what you're going to go about doing. He didn't have that kind of blueprint. He did, as he said, grope for stones as he was crossing the river. But what I think he did have was sort of general direction of things he wanted to do. One of the most exciting times for Deng and all the foreign people he met was his meeting with Frank Press in the summer of 1978, President Carter's scientific advisor. One of my friends, who's since passed away, I used to pal around with in Hong Kong in the 60s, was Mike Oxenberg. And Mike Oxenberg was in on something like 14 meetings with Deng. And he said the most excited he ever saw Deng was in talking to Frank Press, the science advisor, because he really believed that science and technology was the key to the future. And he was really opening up. And it was such excitement to hear all the science. And he insisted in that interview that he wanted to send students to America as soon as they normalized relations by the end of the year. And he wanted to have tens of thousands over there by later in the year. And would America be ready for it? When I interviewed President Carter, Carter said that he was awakened at 3 a.m. one morning with a call from Frank Press from Beijing. And can we accept all those students from China? Carter felt that he didn't need to have that kind of midnight or middle of the night call. But I think it showed how intense Deng was about sending people abroad and learning about what was going on and bring those ideas back to China. So I think that was just so powerful. Even after 1989, June 4th, when foreign sanctions were coming in, Deng said at that time in his speech, we should not only remain open to the outside, we should open even wider. The determination of learning from all over the world was really extraordinary. Another thing I learned about Deng that I hadn't really thought about was his political management of the transition to a more open economy. And I think the term I would use to describe Deng rather than the architect or visionary or reformer, I think is a political manager of the reform process. And just to give one example, when he was decollectivizing, he knew that there were a lot of conservatives who didn't want to break up the collectives, who wanted to keep the production teams or brigades or the communes. And even though he had the highest position in the party, he did not behave like a dictator. What he did, he talked to Wan Li, his good friend who was General Secretary of Anhui Province, and said to Wan Li, if people are starving, and they were probably starving more in Anhui than any other place, if people are really starving, you have to let them find some way to eke out a living in the countryside and to find their ways of eking out living. And sure enough, some people began to use household farming as a way to do it. Deng waited a year or so, and then he sent in reporters to find out what had happened. And the reporters reported that there was lots of increase in grain production on those places where they had tried private household farming. And he brought that news to Beijing. And after another harvest or two, there were all bumper harvests in those areas compared to what they'd been doing before. Deng said about the in the country as a whole, in those areas where local conditions merit and people want to make changes and it would improve the livelihood of the farmers, they should be allowed to practice household contracting, which is essentially private farming. Within a year or so, the place had decollectivized. So Deng was never out on the limb for pushing about the conservatives. It was, in a way, a brilliant, I think, a way of political managing the transition. And the transition from the era where Mao's little aphorisms were memorized by little kids and became the guiding light for all things, and the openness was also, I think, a brilliant way of the way he handled it. He said it doesn't matter if the cat's black or white as long as it catches the mice. That sounds like a very simple aphorism. But what that meant was, if Mao's sayings work, terrific. You don't follow Mao's doings. If it doesn't work, you know, try something else. But he didn't go out on the limb. He didn't attack Mao. Every time he talked about Mao, he said that even though there were some mistakes in his later days, we have to be thankful for all the things that Mao did. So the supporters of Mao found it hard to get too upset, even though, in fact, he was distancing himself from Mao. I think I advertised this talk as about what does this has to do for Hong Kong today or something like this, or what does it mean for China today? And let me just say a few words about what I think all this means. I think that the basic path that Deng led of modernizing and pushing forward with growth and making economic growth the main goal, and learning from all around the world, and especially learning about science and technology, that's still there, and it has remained the dominant guidelines. Deng also said that Tao Guang Yang Hui, it means sort of hide your light under the bushel, don't try to show off too much. Some people have interpreted that to mean that while you were weak, you don't show off, but once you get strong, then you can do things very differently. That's not what Deng meant. What he meant was that we should forever never behave like a hegemon, and we should never try to get too bossy. That will be bad. And while his point of view is now more controversial, because those who see China as strong and see things that they could do from their position of strength, it's no longer as unquestioned as it was during Deng days, but it's still a very dominant point of view. And I think Deng really felt that the irritations with the neighboring countries should not become the central way of defining relations with the foreign countries. You look for common grounds, win-win situation, you say, well, let later generations make some formal distinctions. And he would not be the one who would be pushing in the South China Seas today. So I think that the guidelines for Deng are still very useful today. I don't yet know whether I'll have a chance to go around the mainland speaking about Deng. But I think some of you know that the Chinese edition came out yesterday. at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, both in simplified characters and complex characters. And this means that people in the mainland can have this access, at least indirectly or some people directly, to the Hong Kong edition. And I'm very thankful for the Chinese University Press of Hong Kong for putting out, spending so much time carefully trying to get things just accurately and in correcting a few errors that I had made, the kind of care that they put into checking names and dates and places is really very impressive. I'm very proud of that Chinese edition. And I'm talking now with a mainland publisher. It's possible it will be published in the mainland. And if it is, of course, it will be adapted to the needs of mainland publication, which I think everybody here understands what I mean by that. The question is how much adaptation would be necessary to get it published and how much I would be willing to put up with. But if it's able to get, say, 80-90% of the message published in mainland, my inclination is to go ahead and allow that kind of publication. And since there's no good general book about Deng, I think there is a potential, even though the book is a little long and heavy, and is not the kind of thing that would be read in a bestseller. It's not the kind of thing you would read quickly while you're in the subway on the way to work. But I think there is a potential that interested people, including high-level officials in Beijing and their kids, and academics, might find the book of interest in the internal debate about what the role of Deng should be. So it's kind of fun now seeing the book launched in Hong Kong. And I'm sorry I'll be speaking so many places. I'll repeat a lot of the things I said. So my advice to you is not go to those other places where you hear me say the same things. Although I'll try to say a few little different things. But it's really a great pleasure to be here. I'll be glad to answer questions or argue now as we enter in discussion. Thanks a lot, Tara.
Thanks very much, Professor. Before we open up to questions, I do have one of my own, which is looking at China today, and there's certainly been a lot of political buzz this year and the economy. What would Deng think of today's China? How would he view it? Would he be disgusted? Would he be overjoyed at all his achievements? How do you think he'd see it?
I think that if he came and saw it today, he would be terribly pleased at the two things that he had been working so hard for, the improving the lives of the people and strengthening the position of China around the world, had made so much progress. And as somebody who started out when per capita income was $100 per capita, seeing now whatever, 7,000 or whatever it is on the average, seeing that change, it would have to be satisfying to the person who set that in motion. I think he would be very upset at the amount of corruption. When he was getting started in the late 70s and early 80s, he felt that to get officials who were so frightened from the Cultural Revolution of doing anything, that if he were too strict with them, they wouldn't be daring to do things. And he said, "Ganzo." He wanted young cadres who were willing to push ahead. And so that meant not being too critical. And if they put a little in their pocket, that didn't manage that matter that much, as long as they got the local economy going. I think that's the way he felt at that time. But by the time he was stepping down already in the late 70s, he was very concerned about the amount of corruption going on. And he said, "We got to deal with those things with two fists. One fist is reform and opening. The other fist is clamp down on that kind of improper behavior." So I think he would move more boldly in dealing with corruption. And another thing he said fairly early was, some people will get rich earlier. Now that means that after some people get rich, they should help others get rich. And the eventual goal was getting everybody rich. And I think he would be disappointed that while some got rich early, it was not moving fast enough to get the rest of the country rich. And I think he would be doing a lot of things to push even harder on getting the wealth out to the people who don't yet have it. So that's my, having lived with the guy for 10 years, That's my sort of gut feeling as to what he would feel if he came here today.
Thank you very much. We have microphones. If you raise your hand, tell us your name and your organization, and we'll take questions. Right over here.
Thank you. Elsie Nielsen, I'm a lawyer. Mr. Fogel, you were just talking about, this is a follow-up question to the answer to Tara Joseph. You were saying that he will be very upset about the corruption. But by the time of 1989, he was still very much in power. Why didn't, in my understanding, the corruption problem by that time was rampant already. And in fact, one of the causes for the student uprising was corruption. If he were to care so much about corruption, if he did care about cramming down corruption, why did he do what he did? And, June 4th. And why didn't he do more to cram down? Even after the Tiananmen massacre, he could have done more to crack down on the corruption. Thank you.
I think he was still at the stage in 1989 where he wanted the economy to drive forward very fast and for local officials to still push very hard on changing things. But he did do things about corruption, and there were large cases that he tried to publicize. I think his approach for dealing with corruption was very similar to kind of traditional imperial approach. Kill the rooster to warn the monkey, and you take big cases of corruption and publicize them and give a lot of attention. He did that, and in the late 80s, he was supportive of a number of those cases. So I think he was doing things, and since corruption has gotten so much worse since that, I think he would do more things. Now, why he did what he did on June 4th, I think June 4th was an unfortunate, tragic combination of a lot of circumstances. Hu Yaobang died, was unpredictable. I think some were errors that Deng had made. In 1988, he allowed inflation to go too high, and he also tried to deregulate prices at a time when inflation was so high that a lot of the ordinary people in the cities who were on salary were seeing inflation around them 30-40% and terribly worried about their future and therefore willing to support demonstrations. Also, it happened that foreign journalists were present because of Gorbachev, and while Gorbachev was there, he didn't want to clamp down early, so he let things go until Gorbachev left. And then after Gorbachev left, he sent in troops, and you recall that on May 20th, when troops first were sent in, they were told not to shoot, they were sent in unarmed, and they were to try to keep order. I think he was completely surprised by the fact that they met so much resistance. For the troops were not even told what to do for contingency plans if they were slowed down. They didn't know that. But here you are, May 20th, troops are sent in, try to keep order, and they can't do it. They're stopped cold in their tracks. They withdraw, and what do you do next at that point? I think it was not just Deng, but I think all the top leadership felt at that particular time there was no choice but to tell the troops to go in, to move in, to keep order, to do what you have to do, including shooting the guns. And he had broadcasts sent out to people to stay off the streets, and he told the soldiers were told that they were to shoot in the air and they were to shoot pellets. But when the resistance continued, they were to do what was necessary, and so they shot. I think if Deng were asked throughout his life, was that the right decision, he would say yes. I haven't seen any signs that he ever had any doubts about that basic decision. And when I interviewed Jiang Zemin about that issue, that's exactly what he said. He said that not only Deng, but the other people felt that that was the only choice at that point. It was the danger of the place really falling apart. One way I thought about these things is the difference between him and Hu Yaobang. Hu Yaobang had been general secretary of the Youth League while he was general secretary of the party. Hu Yaobang, as head general secretary of the Youth League, tried to get youth enthusiastic. He was encouraged. He was supportive. They had recreational activities. But Deng, as general secretary, the buck stopped there. And whether China fell apart or whether it stuck together, he felt he was responsible. Perhaps he was overly conservative, but that was the way he looked at it. And the way I see my role as somebody writing this up, I don't think I should apologize for Deng. He did terrible things, and I remember watching television and thinking how terrible that was, and I've never changed my view of that. But I think as a person describing this event, I have to describe why he did what he did and explain what his thinking was and what were the circumstances that caused him to feel that way. I think that's the job of a scholar looking at that. That's what I've tried to do.
Thank you. Right here in the front. Oh, sorry, you've got, well, we'll go there and we'll come back to you. Please, sir, the microphone's right there.
My name is Richard Liu, too old to be employable, too old to have caught you when you were lecturing at Harvard. I have a question, if you care to all share your insight and knowledge about Mr. Deng after he died. And to frame that properly, I'd like to quickly read just a few sentences. And I'm quoting, "It is history's responsibility to make China a first-rate country by building it into a true democracy of and by the people. 建一个权力来源于人民, based on a fair and equitable legal system, 法治公平的政治国家. This was Sun Yat-sen's dream. 这也是孙中山的初想. After it is achieved, we can then talk about long governance and eternal peace, 长治久安. What I just read is a translation of Mr. Deng's writing to his children in June 1992, 5 years before his death.
I don't want to interrupt you. You speak beautifully. I just want to get to the question.
The question is, what would you like? Would you care to share your knowledge and insight on Mr. Deng, the manager of political realities, and the private person? And what would have been the implication if this was known to in China?
I think that Deng was never against political reform. When he was a student at Sun Yat-sen University in Moscow from 1926 to 27, he wrote a piece in which he said, the question of political reform depends on the political situation in the country. And if the political situation in the country is such, people support it, you can go about political reform. In August 1980, he made a very interesting speech about what he thought political reform should be carried out. In 1986, when he was planning to pass the baton to Zhao Ziyang, he allowed Zhao Ziyang to have a very comprehensive study of what kind of political reforms might be used for China. One person who was teaching here in Hong Kong for a while, Wu Guoguang, was a young staff member at that time and wrote about it in a very detailed way, that effort to evaluate political reform. So I think Deng would have felt that if the situation was sufficiently stable, you can allow more. When the democracy wall started in December 78, he allowed it to go on. But when the people began criticizing the party so much, he felt that it was danger of falling apart. So he tried at that point to establish certain baselines about what people could criticize. And as long as they were within those basic lines of supporting socialism and the party in power and so forth, they could have lots of criticisms. But he was afraid that China might fall apart, and that while it was in danger of falling apart, you had to keep order, do what's necessary to keep order. He was a soldier for 12 years, and he was ready to do what he felt was necessary to keep order.
Hi there, my name is Dan. I'm also a lawyer here in Hong Kong. Deng Xiaoping was undoubtedly a very skillful and shrewd political operator, but I've always been interested in how to characterize his political philosophy. And as a way of doing that, I'd be interested in your thoughts on the following. Which leader would he be most similar to, in your view? A Lee Kuan Yew, a Chiang Kai-shek, an Augusto Pinochet, a Benito Mussolini, or the Kangxi Emperor? If there's another candidate, I'd also be interested in working out where he falls, where you'd place him. Thanks very much.
I have no doubt of that list. The person he would have liked best is Lee Kuan Yew. When the two of them first met in November 78, they really hit it off. And they were very considerate of each other. And some of you may know the story that because Deng smoked and drank and spit, that Lee Kuan Yew had a special duct built in his office that would carry out the smoke, and he had a spittoon set down there for Deng's arrival. And when Deng arrived and they had the talk, Deng did not smoke during the thing. He did not spit during the thing. And I think when I asked Lee Kuan Yew about Deng, he said, of all the many leaders that he met around the world, none did he have more respect for than Deng, because Deng was willing to take a country that he had grown up in, and realizing that different things were required, take it on an entirely new path. And Deng kept going back and meeting Lee Kuan Yew. They met very often. And you know, one of the things they were studying in 1986 is how a single party system might stay in power even if you have voting. And I think it's not an accident that they were studying that kind of issue. I think from Deng's point of view, Singapore was clean and green, and people had respect for law. Lee Kuan Yew was much more enlightened than some of the other names you mentioned. And they met on five or six occasions. Some of those, like the first one, were for several days. So I think they knew each other very well and had enormous respect for each other. I think of the two people outside mainland China, the two people who were closest to Deng, I think were the deepest understanding. One was Lee Kuan Yew. The other, I would say, is Y.K. Bao. Y.K. Bao developed a very close relationship with Deng, and the family saw each other a lot. And they really understood each other very well.
Time for two more questions. We'll start here.
I'm To Han Shi, a reporter from the South China Morning Post. Can you briefly describe what Deng's relationship was with Bo Yibo? And now that Bo Xila is out of power, do you think, you know, he still has a lot of support from some very powerful people in China? And do you think Wen Jiabao, by kicking down Bo Xilai, will suffer repercussions a few years down the road the way Liu Shaoqi suffered repercussions for criticizing Mao Zedong before the Cultural Revolution?
First of all, his relation with Bo Yibo, they were seniors in the very early period. In 1952, Mao criticized Bo Yibo for the way he was handling finance. He was giving private enterprise the same taxation base he was giving to other people. And he went through a very big, he was that time Minister of Finance, and Mao threw him out. Do you know who he chose to be Bo Yibo's replacement? Deng Xiaoping. He became Finance Minister immediately after Bo Yibo. And his job was to try to provide a tax base that would weaken private industry and sort of strengthen collectives. I think if you fast forward a few years, of course, Boy Bo was pushed out during the Cultural Revolution the same way Deng was. And I think when Boy Bo came back after that time, they were part of the elders and seniors. I don't think that they had a group of eight who met during the June 4th period, as some people do. I think that Tiananmen papers, I have serious doubts as to whether that's an accurate rendition. But I have no doubt that even during those Tiananmen era, he remained close to Boy Bo and the seniors, and that Boy Bo was a very smart guy and very much in favor of opening, and had very similar policies, and certainly believed in the return of the senior officials as Deng had. And the question of Bo Xilai, I think if I were on the standing committee, and we're going to remain there for the next 5-10 years, I would not want Bo Xilai to be one of my group. He appeals, he's a populist who goes too much to the public, and he has his own ideas. He talks about Mao's slogans. He's not a team player, and therefore I would select him out and not make him as a candidate for the Standing Committee of the Politburo. I think personally my own analysis is that Bo Xilai had such a big following in Chongqing and in Dalian and Liaoning and other places where he'd been that they could not quietly keep him off the standing committee. And from the point of view of the people in Beijing, that in order to keep him off the standing committee, they had to do a lot to weaken his base of popular support in every way they can. If I may mention just one personal contact, and maybe I hope you don't publicize this, but Bo Guagba came to talk to me last week about his family situation, and he was very worried about what might happen to his mother, and I think very frightened. And I would say, although I don't know him well, that the stuff about his Playboy stuff is greatly exaggerated. He has to take courses at Kennedy School. He has to pass the courses. He was a serious young person. So I think the talk of his Playboy characteristics are just greatly exaggerated. It's hard to see what might happen in the future about Bo Xilai, but I would guess that within 2 or 3 years this might well blow over. If I were at the central leadership in handling the issues, after I sentenced Bo Xilai and his wife, I would be slightly lenient in carrying out the sentence, so that the people who supported him would not be so angry at the high-level officials. I'd do everything I could to discredit him, make people feel that this is a real scoundrel. But once having carried out the sentence, then I would lighten it. I don't know whether people in Beijing will handle it that way, but that's what I would do if I were in their position. Thank you.
We're running low on time, but we have one more journalist question back here.
Hello, Professor Boga. I'm not a journalist. I'm actually an architect who sat in on your lectures 30 years ago at Harvard, your Asia series. So it's great to see you in Hong Kong.
Thank you.
Deng Xiaoping is often credited with being the architect of Shenzhen, and Shenzhen being the kind of cradle of economic reform has grown. We all know the story, from 30,000 to 15 million. What do you think Deng Xiaoping would think of Shenzhen today, with himself deified? He's like a god there. There's a statue on the top of the hill of Shenzhen's achievements. And do you think the Shenzhen model is still a good role model for China today? Thank you.
After 1979, Deng was slow in pushing for urban reform, and he had visited Bao'an County before it became Shenzhen municipality with Ye Jianing just before he took office in 1978. And then he went back to Shenzhen in January 1984. And that's when he looked out at the buildings, and he was very proud of Shenzhen. And he invited a lot of the Central Committee members and other high officials to come and see Shenzhen. And I think Shenzhen did a wonderful job of providing guest houses in the wintertime when high officials could come and spend their winter vacation in warmer weather, so they were able to show off Shenzhen. And Deng used that rapid construction. Deng loved buildings. He didn't know the inside of technology, but he could see that progress in 1984. He continued to support Shenzhen during that time. In my book, I spend a whole chapter talking about the Nanxin Tanhua in 1992, as you know, when Deng Xiaoping came south and visited Guangzhou and Shenzhen and Zhuhai. And that's where he lit the fire for pushing forward rapidly again in 1992. He was really afraid that Jiang Zemin had been in too much working with the conservatives, slowing down. And so he was, that was his base for pushing his last great push forward. He was 88 years, he was turning 88 that year. And he was using Shenzhen as a basis of stirring up Beijing to push ahead faster. He would be very proud of what goes on in Shenzhen. He would have been, if he had come to see it, he would regard that as one of his, it was one kind of a model for what a modern city and modern industry, modern construction could be. And he would have been very proud of it.
I see VG really wants to sneak in a last question.
A short one, I'll make it. As an old friend of the FCC, going back to about 50 years, when the FCC used to be in the Hilton Hotel, where the Cheung Kong building stands now. I'll throw a soft one at you.
Thank you.
Back in the 80s, you became almost a rock star, not an easy thing for an academic, by publishing Japan as number one. Almost everybody in Tokyo would recognize you. Now, you've written something of a blockbuster, hopefully, on China. How soon do you think you'll become a rock star and recognizable as such in China?
I wish I could control that. It's beyond my control, but it's possible that the Chinese edition of the book could come out as early as 2 months from now. And I'm dealing with a publisher, and if they have their way, it would come out right away. And I was invited a year or so to give a talk on Deng at a Chinese university. And I was surprised how open and lively the discussion was. And there's a thing called the China Forum in Shanghai, the Academy of Social Sciences there, are doing the fall. They've already invited me as the keynote speaker. So, I didn't write the book to become a rock star. You know, I would feel much prouder if I were thought of as an academic who really contributed to the understanding of China. But I've written quite a few books, and the only one that made me a rock star was Japan is Number One, as you say. And I do have the feeling there's some kind of the same kind of tectonic vibrations that I sense as I talk to China, as I hear from my friends in Beijing, where they've run into some Gao Ganzadi, some kid of the high-level officials who's heard about the book and now wants to get a copy. So it's possible that I could have some impact within China. Thank you very much.
And we'll leave it on that note. Professor Vogel, thanks very much for your time today. A small gift from the club in appreciation of your coming. Have a good afternoon, everyone.